We're still waiting for a quorum, but we'll begin. They should be arriving soon. Before we begin the presentation, I forgot on Monday to, I guess, just reflect on our visit to Brown College last week for the benefit of a few that weren't there. And I guess basically it was a nice evening, head by all. Had a nice five-course meal. Does anyone want to add to that? Who was there besides me?
I was there.
You were there, yeah.
Just remember, I welcomed you to the Democratic caucus.
That's right. You're right.
Well, I, Mr. Chair, I had not been to Brown College to see the culinary arts at work there, and it was really great. That was a wonderful idea to get together with the Senate and the House that way, and it was great to see that training that those students are doing. I know that what they were appreciative of seeing us there, too.
I just wanted to acknowledge the fact that the committee was there along with the Senate, and it was a good experience. Representative Dempsey.
Mr. Chairman, not often do people, when they go out for dinner, at least I don't, they expect the kind of elegance of the people that served us and the people that provide the services, and then the finality of it was is the greatness of the food, truly in the French design, where you had many, many different options, and I think there were six or seven different types of food that we had that was very elegant and done in small sections, but small amounts, but in a greater number. It was really, if you ever want to go someplace that is kind of unique in dinnering today, that's the place to go. It was a very good experience, and I appreciated the opportunity. And we not only talked to the senators and the representatives, but we talked to the students. And that, too, was very informative and enlightening, to be quite frank with you. So I appreciated the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, to be there. It was a very good experience.
It was a lesson in how to eat slowly and healthy.
And over a long period of
yes.
time.
If you've got 3 hours, it's a great meal.
Mr. Chairman, for the benefit of the audience, we should, however, point out that that was private pay. It was not provided by Brown.
That is
college.
Correct.
Yeah.
For the record, that's right.
But wouldn't want people to misunderstand
yeah.
the...
It really is
the environment we're in. Yeah.
That's right. We do.
Had been Frank's.
Frank's, yes.
I'll give the Euro dollars today.
We do have a quorum. I'd like to officially begin our hearing of the Higher Education Committee. And before we begin the testimony, maybe we should deal with the minutes. We'd like to offer the minutes if you've had a moment to look at them.
No problem.
Senator Latz moves the minutes of Monday, March the 7th. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And the minutes are approved. Okay. Sorry for that discourse on food for a moment. But,
I think food is wonderful. I'm highly supportive of food.
Yes. We would like to welcome you to our committee.
Thank you.
And you are Deborah Powell.
I am indeed. Yes. Chairman Nornes and members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here on behalf of the University of Minnesota to present part of the university's funding request titled Biosciences for a Healthy Minnesota. I am indeed Deborah Powell, and I'm the Dean of the Medical School at the University of Minnesota, and my other title is Assistant Vice President for Clinical Sciences at the University and the Academic Health Center. And I've been in Minnesota for about 2 years, coming here from Kansas, where I was Dean of the Medical School at the University of Kansas School of Medicine. My background in medical training is as a pathologist. Most of you see us as people on CSI or Law and Order and think of forensic pathologists, but we really are physicians who serve at the interface of science and medical practice. And so I do want to take this opportunity as a pathologist and as the dean to talk about a little bit of the remarkable work that's being done at the by the faculty at the university. I think that biosciences at the University of Minnesota has an amazing opportunity because we are part of a major research university. And biosciences, the sciences related to human health and animal health and health of the land and the air really thrive in research institutions like that here at Minnesota. For all of us, I think we appreciate that great research really happens when different disciplines come together to study problems, where disciplines touch. Because the differences between how an engineer or a mathematician and a physician look at a problem are very different. But when they come together and work together, true breakthroughs and true new knowledge happen that can promote better health, better treatments, and ultimately better lives for people in Minnesota. And that happened here at this medical school, this university, 50 years ago, when an engineer, Earl Bakken, and a physician, cardiovascular surgeon, Walt Lillehei, came together to produce the battery-operated pacemaker that led to the foundation of Medtronic and the amazing medical device industry, which is second to none in this state. So those interactions between different disciplines are incredibly important. And at the University of Minnesota, we are really fortunate because we have so many different disciplines studying, learning, teaching, and doing research side by side. It's a great advantage for our medical school because we have not only the university and its schools, and particularly the College of Biological Sciences, but also all of the colleges in the medical center. So we learn from our colleagues in veterinary medicine and public health and dentistry and nursing and pharmacy, and that's wonderful. And that's the reason that I came here. We have wonderful facilities for our scientists work together. And with the College of Biological Sciences, we have the Molecular and Cellular Biology Building, which was dedicated as I was arriving. And that's great because the open design of the facility means that scientists working on discoveries will very quickly translate those down the lab to people working in different areas, and it produces synergies which are unparalleled. And pretty soon you're all going to receive invitations to the opening of the new translational research facility, for which we are very grateful, which is going to be dedicated as the newest building for bioscience research at the university. And it will be completed on time, and very importantly, it will be completed on budget. So hope we can welcome you there soon. Today I want to introduce people who are going to talk about specific areas of biosciences for healthy Minnesota. And we're going to focus on three of the initiatives that I think showcase the interdisciplinary strength of the university. And we hope to show you the potential for Minnesota in our work in new products through biotechnology, brain function across the lifespan, and healthy foods and healthy lives. We're going to start with a presentation on healthy foods and healthy lives and the importance of making certain that healthy foods are actually safe foods. You probably have read that the university was awarded a $15 million grant by the Department of Homeland Security to establish the National Center for Food Protection and Defense. This center is a national consortium of academic, public sector, and industry partners and is led by the University of Minnesota. And two of the center's associate directors are with us today to present to you. One is Michael Osterholm, who is an international expert on bioterrorism and head of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the university and a faculty member in our School of Public Health. And he will be joined by Sean Kennedy, who also serves as an associate director of our Center for Animal Health and Food Safety and who brings to the university great experience and expertise in food safety, animal health, research and development at Ecolab and at Procter & Gamble. So I'd like to introduce Drs. Osterholm and Kennedy.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Mike Osterholm, indicated by Dean Paul, Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, as well as Associate Director of the new National Center for Food Protection and Defense. And I will start out the presentation this afternoon and share the conclusion of that presentation with the Associate Director, Sean Kennedy.
Can I ask you to maybe move the mic around so it's a little closer?
Thank you. Actually,
I spent the better part of my career here in Minnesota testifying before you, usually in my role at the Minnesota Department of Health, reporting on such things as disease outbreaks, and there are some familiar faces in this committee that I remember very well talking about those. Today we're here to talk about something a little different than the construct of a disease outbreak or the fact that people get sick from eating food. Even though we talk about the fact that we have the safest food supply in the world, very few people realize that about 76 million Americans each year get sick from eating food. About 5,000 die, and about 325,000 hospitalizations occur as a result of getting sick from eating food. In this state, as well as throughout this country, the number one reason for an emergency room visit in this country is foodborne disease. So from that standpoint, we do have work to do to assure that those who consume those wonderful meals, regardless of where they're served or who serves them, is that also you don't take home something else with you that you had not intended. And given the serious nature of some of these, it's obviously a problem. What you're about to hear about today is actually something different than the construct of food safety. Everyone realizes following 9/11 that this country is vulnerable in many ways to those who might want to do harm to either us individually or our economy. One of the areas that we so well know that we're vulnerable is in our food supply. We have a very complicated food supply. If you go from the pre-farm inputs of chemicals and seeds and feeds and so forth all the way to the final processed product, whether it's sold in a restaurant, whether it's served in your home, a hospital, or the cafeteria here at the state office building, the bottom line is that there's a lot of different processes, fingers, hands, and locations that get involved with this food supply. And so what we're here today to talk about is how to help preserve, actually, the safety of the food supply beyond that of the regular safety, but that of an intentional harm that might come to it. In terms of the government response, Homeland Security Presidential Decision Directive number 9 actually established the food and agricultural sector as a critical infrastructure. They actually said, yes, we understand how important food is, not just in the sense that we all, obviously, it's near and dear to us as we eat it every day, but also it is a major part of our economic engine in this country. And so part of this was to develop awareness of this issue, develop early warning capabilities to respond to an attack, to mitigate any of the vulnerabilities. If we could actually make it so foolproof that it would deter terrorists, that's the ideal. How do we actually enhance screening to make sure that the food is safe so that if someone should have done something to it, we can detect it before it causes harm, and then to enhance response and recovery. We look no further than some of the non-intentional events such as bovine spongiform encephalopathy, BSE, or foot and mouth disease in Great Britain to understand what a disease can do to an industry. It can be devastating. Also, part of Presidential Decision Directive 9 is to establish university centers of excellence to basically capture the best and the brightest of the university academic world to help assist the federal government in this effort. So it was that the Department of Homeland Security set up a series of centers of excellence, of which we happen to be the one dealing with the food system basically from farm to table. The National Center for Food Protection and Defense vision is one of defending the safety of the food system through research and education. Notice the highlighted safety, food system, research, and education. We're really the glue that holds together many disparate parts of a large private sector, public sector effort in this area. This is a mission-driven activity in which we collaborate with the Department of Homeland Security with both private and public sector stakeholders. I'll show you in a moment how widespread our net is in that regard. And again, our effort is to defend the safety of the food system by reducing the likelihood of an intentional attack. And that's a difficult thing for us to talk about. For many of you in this room that might want to inquire about that, the mere fact of talking about it in certain ways might very well enhance the potential it could happen, because if somebody didn't know that was a weak link, now they would. And so we have to walk a very fine line between actually illuminating the problem and providing information about it, and also not giving bad guys or potential bad guys ideas about what to do. We improve the nation's ability to effectively respond. We have to acknowledge in a system that can have 76 million illnesses a year with it, there are some holes. There's some places where something's already not working as well as it could or should to have those kinds of illnesses. And finally, again, to reduce the consequences of an intentional attack. Reduce it not only in terms of human or animal morbidity or mortality, but also the economic implications. We leverage our unique advantages here. We are a neutral convener for the food system issues. For example, with industry, they have many concerns about sharing certain data with regulatory enforcement agencies, of which the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Food and Drug Administration, and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture happen to be. So that there are some reluctance in some occasions to be able to come open and just say, here's all of our issues, what do we do? At the same time, in terms of being able to do that, academia also serves as the link between oftentimes trade associations and national labs to pull together what do we know, how do we know it, and what can we do something about, and that's what we're really all about. We cover the whole food system, as I mentioned, from pre-farm inputs through consumption. There is a second center that was established at Texas A&M, which is dealing with foreign animal diseases. They have a series of diseases that they're dealing with that would be carved out there, but they are not specifically something that we cover, but if should an event occur, obviously we don't worry about foot and mouth disease hurting humans from the standpoint of infection, but we do worry about its disruption of the food system. In addition, we focus on catastrophic events. We're not here to focus on seven people got sick, you know, at the church picnic because somebody necessarily put salmonella in the potato salad. That would obviously be not a good thing. But from the standpoint of what we approach the many large things. I will tell you now, and anyone who knows this business well knows that these figures are quite accurate. We could literally create events for you today that would not be that difficult to execute that could involve 200 to 300,000 people and many, many thousands of deaths where someone who knew what they were doing intentionally harmed the food system. That's what we're after. We're after the many catastrophic events, and we've done things to actually impact on that already. We're also here to build strong private sector and academic partners, and we'll show you how we're working closely with both those groups in a moment, and then actually also to build professional capacity in food defense. We've never trained a workforce. We've never trained academic researchers to think like bad guys think. We have trained them to think like bugs might think, or people who accidentally forget to shut a valve might think. And so we've actually had to create almost a different mindset and training to be able to bring together the expertise that could look at water flowing uphill, not downhill. What would make that happen? What would be the consequences? In terms of our broad academic collaboration, as Dean Powell mentioned, we lead this effort. However, we're just one of 19 different institutions. We're very proud of the groups that we have. We have five primary partners across the top, most notably the University of Wisconsin, North Dakota State University, Georgia Tech, and University of Tennessee. You can see all the different groups here. We might add that we were one of the few organizations that had the timidity, I guess, to actually put the North Dakota State University as a principal investigator in Harvard, merely as just another add-on to the group. You see Harvard right below that, but they too are quite involved with this effort. In addition, this reflects the diverse industry and association collaboration. Many of these logos are very familiar to you. It's not of any surprise that there are a number of Minnesota-based companies here because, frankly, companies like the Cargills, Hormels, and others of the world actually are, in their respective areas, some of the largest food producers or processors in the world. And so that it's not a surprising that they're there. But you can see we've engaged a number of different parties to work collaboratively with us in this particular area. Now, if you look at our research needs and how they are focused, you can actually see here that we focus really around a continuum of any number of different activities. If I start at the very top, detection and diagnostics today, we don't have a lot of good test methods to find that needle in the haystack in a food supply. It's very different than testing a food matrix or something in a food item than it is in blood. And so what we're attempting to do today is build a whole set of test methods that could be used to help assist us. Also, security in food packaging and processing. The issue of how can we make a food safe. We all know about what happened with our medication bottles after someone tampered with the Tylenol and cyanide issue. But today there are many food items that lend themselves to poor packaging, easy access to someone who might want to introduce something into that. How can we deal with that? The idea of economic analysis. I can tell you that a very minor event in this country would have major economic impact throughout many aspects of our country, whether it be in the actual agricultural growing area, but also in the processing area. And one need not even actually perpetrate an event. One just has to threaten an event and make people believe it could happen. And we could give you examples where we could contaminate one food item, call some regulator to tell them to go find it on a food shelf, and they find it and document it's there, and then to merely say, well, I did that all over the country. You would then have to pull that product literally all over the country. even though they didn't do it beyond that one product, you wouldn't know. And so we have to deal with the kinds of consequences that occur with that. We get into disposal and decontamination. It's one thing to get rid of a few pounds of contaminated product, but what if a chemical has been introduced into a particular food item in the metric tons, and we only find out about it? How can we dispose of it? Then we get into public health and epidemiology. How can we mitigate the impact on our society in terms of illness, supply chain information and management? When we look at all the issues before us from every aspect of our economy, ask anyone who knows supply chain management, ask anyone that does systems analysis, and they'll tell you that there is nothing more complicated than the food chain. From the standpoint of the pre-farm inputs all around the world, most of our food today, when we say we have the safest food supply in the world, my response is we have the world's food supply. If you understand where your produce comes from today, just take a look at that, and you'll see 5 days ago that was in a developing country farm field that today now is on your shelf. And if you look at the pre-farm inputs to the actual farming, to all the different kinds of things we eat, many grocery stores today have over 60,000 different items available that come from around the world. Then look at all the ways they're processed, the ways they're packaged, the way that they're then moved through commerce, the way that they're ultimately then prepared and served to you, and you can understand the complexity of our food supply. And then finally, we have an industry work group that is, as I mentioned before, part of our effort that plays a big role in helping us work through this. I would like to turn it over to Sean to actually show you an example of some of the things we're working with. This is actually a food incident model we've built to give people a sense of what would happen and how we might intercede if, in fact, a single product were contaminated. And I'll let him go through with this.
Thank you, Mike. Good afternoon, Mr.
Welcome
Chairman and committee members. As Dean Powell indicated, I'm Sean Kennedy, the Associate Director for this center, as well as for the Center for Animal Health and Food Safety. And what you'll see on the screen now is one of the research products that's being developed within our program that I'll demonstrate. And this is a model for understanding how an intentional or an unintentional attack on the food system might actually play out. And we developed these models to identify weaknesses within the current system so that we can address those weaknesses with the remediations that improve our ability to prevent and respond to a food system event. And what I'm going to walk you through now is one example that we've got loaded in. And one of the unique aspects of this, the examples we're showing you, is that we have to pick something where we actually understand the distribution system in order to ensure we know what would happen if there were an intentional contamination. So in this case, we've got an event loaded, which is, and follow the mouse, you see where the cursor is now. I've clicked on Donovan's Frozen Desserts. We have the historical distribution data for our premium ice cream product moving out of the Twin Cities area that we've used to populate this model. So we've been working with our industry partners to make sure we have real data. In this case, we're going to contaminate the ice cream with botulinum toxin. It's going to be done in summer, and we're going to contaminate one bulk tank. And for those of you that haven't been in a food processing plant, the bulk tank is the large storage tank that the ice cream would be in right before it goes into the packaging line. One of those bulk tanks holds 170,000 pints of ice cream. So if you contaminated one bulk tank, you've contaminated 170,000 units that will go into distribution. It's been contaminated with a lethal dose. Public health response time is 2 days, which, as Mike could comment on, is in this case probably realistic because of the very unique presentation of botulism infection. And there are no unique subpopulations, as you'll hear in the lower right. I'm going to open up this event and just quickly pause it so you can explain what you're seeing. You go down here on the lower left. This column that will be rising up shows the product moving in through the distribution chain. Then as it moves from distribution, it goes to retail. Then it goes into the consumer's home. Then how many people have eaten it, how many people get sick, how many medical attention has been sought, public health system cases, and mortalities. If you watch what happens up here, this shows you the elapsed time from the contamination, and down it will show up here as soon as it starts running, will be the calculated or estimated economic costs of the event. Okay. So if I now continue with this, you see that it already hit the distribution chain, and those black dots are distribution hubs coming out of this transportation corridor. So it's already in multi-states before you get to 24 hours after the contamination. you're in retail in just over a day from the contamination event. And this, while it is historical data, is obviously simulated. As it continues to move through the system, you see the bars growing on the left, and then at 2 days, 2 hours, you're in home already. So in less than 2.5 days from the initial contamination, you already have the chance for it to be in the home for potential consumption. And then the food consumed, estimated because of the shopping patterns, and this is loaded with that information, in 3 days. So now if you see those dots spreading across the country, you have your first illness in 4 days and a couple hours. You already have this product greatly distributed across the United States. So at the point in time where you had your first illness, you had half the product already in retail and about 5% of it in the home. Now as you move forward, as we continue to see the numbers rise, you see very limited in the cost area. The totals are fairly small. Those are simply because it's first illness, you're just calculating lost work time. Now in 7 days you seek medical attention. So now we've got the first possible chance for detection of the event. And public health system alerted. And just a very quick pause, if you look at that, if public health system had perfect response capability, this would be the first time we could say there's been an attack, we know that it's ice cream, and we need to stop. At that point in time, you've already had 106,000 individuals consume the product. You have most of the product in the retailer or in the home, and you've already got 18,000 people ill. So you can see the scope of the problem we're facing, and that by the time you detect an event, in many cases, it's too late to stop the consumption of the food. So we have to do a great deal to improve our ability to protect the food system from the event. But as Mike pointed out earlier, we also have to improve our ability to respond to the event so that we can decrease morbidity and mortality once it occurs. Now, I'll just let this run for a few more minutes, a few more seconds, actually. And as you see in the central section here again, we have none in distribution. We have very little in home. We have, in retail, some in home. Basically, it's mostly been consumed. And this is about the time in which you would start seeing a normal public health system response. And then you have your first mortality. Now, if you run this out to the conclusion of the probable event, which would be, in this case, if you assume appropriate health, appropriate intervention, we would run this about to 3 weeks. At that three-week period, you would go from the current totals of 2,000 people dead and 64,000 ill to around 6,000 dead and a $315 billion hit on the American economy. And that is the reason why the Department of Homeland Security has stood up these research centers to try and help plug some of the holes in our current food system. And we're very proud at the University of Minnesota to have the opportunity to lead this effort. So I will now stop the model
and we'll conclude here. This gives you an opportunity to see the kinds of events we're talking about. This, unfortunately, is an all-too-realistic event. It could happen without necessarily having sophisticated terrorist training. In summary, our food protection and defense is in everyone's interest. We all eat, and the farm-to-table industry is a critical economic sector. This last outbreak examination really identifies both of those factors as key. Our job is to defend and secure our food supply, and it poses a significant challenge in that for many years we never thought of someone intentionally harming our food supply. In fact, many of the control programs we put into place was to widely identify where Mother Nature could make a mistake or do something to us and make sure everyone knew where those problems were. Today, that is actually the recipe to figure out how to get around all the things we've been working on for the last 100 years to improve the safety of the food supply. We are working on improvements. We do believe that we can do certain things that will actually greatly reduce the likelihood of these things happening, and that the National Center for Food Protection and Defense surely has a very central and unique role in this area, and we're very honored to be there. The last comment I'd just like to make is we did some calculations briefly to look at how we've leveraged our activities here. And actually, over 2 years ago, our Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy received a grant from the NTI, Ted Turner's Foundation, to begin this work, and it laid the groundwork for what ultimately became our proposal to the DHS, Department of Homeland Security, for this particular activity. Overall, that grant, and along with the $15 million brought in from the DHS, a total of about $15.5 million, was leveraged with about $120,000 of state money. It gives you a sense of the economic engine that our university plays, as well as the actual activities that they spin out and protect the economy and the safety of our state. So we're very happy to answer any questions you may have in this regard about our activities.
Thank you, Dr. Osterholm. Dr. Kennedy, Representative Mariani.
Thank you. I'm not a public health expert, but as I look through the case scenario, the thought I had was that looks like a public health. It looks like something that people in public health normally do and would be doing. How much of this is a redundancy, if any, in terms of what our public health systems are set up to do? What is the value-added component of your specialized effort vis-a-vis to our public health systems?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Representative Moranis. The issue you saw there is that we're not there to duplicate anything public health is doing. Basically, we involve public health because the kinds of tests we come up with and the kinds of work we're doing, they have to fit into that system. But having come from the public health system for so many years, I would just add that the public health system right now is skating on very thin ice. There have been a number of cuts that have been enacted in the public health system of the state over the past several years, and federal dollars have not been commensurate to those cuts. On top of that, the federal dollars are now being cut. Actually, the very people who would be on the front lines of this for the Minnesota Department of Health, actually the Preventive Block Grant, which has been a very important federal source of money to state health departments, is there has actually been a rebate phenomena this year where they've had to basically rescind a certain amount of money they got, and it's zeroed out next year. So I don't want anyone to think that there is any redundancy, one. Number two is there's not much to skate on here. The third thing I would just point out to you, that one of the things you have to understand is our capacity from a medical care delivery system standpoint. Right now in this country, there are about 105,000 mechanical ventilators to keep people alive when they need assistance breathing. And any one given day, 75,000 to 80,000 of those are in use. During the flu season, as Dr. Powell can tell you, we approach 100,000 of those being in use. To keep people alive who have botulism, you need mechanical ventilation. We will not keep most people alive when they develop botulism, because we don't have the capability to respond to this. Just as our healthcare system was in divert status in a number of days this winter in the Twin Cities where no emergency rooms were open for ambulances to go to, one of the things that concern us about a large foodborne outbreak like this is the fact that we would not only overwhelm the public health system, but we would very quickly overwhelm the medical care system. We would not have care for many of these people who have botulism like this in our communities. So it gives you a sense. There's no redundancy here, I promise you.
Representative Maria.
So here are a number of important things here. Those of us in policy need to rethink our public health investments and perhaps recontextualize those investments in a world that's different than even just a few short years ago. But I also hear a call for greater coordination, greater emphasis on collaboration that perhaps challenges us also in terms of investments. So what is the state of our collaborative efforts across the key, whether it's public health or medical facilities, even just your local rapid response teams? I know this is sort of a simplistic question, but if we were to put it on a scale 1 to 10, where are we in terms of our ability to be responsibly responsive in terms of coordination and collaboration?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ryan, I would have to say our collaboration coordination is extremely high.
Okay.
And I feel very confident that having come from a public sector position like I did for 30 years and then being in the university setting, I can tell you it's there. I think you would hear from Dean Powell and others about the importance of why what we're talking about here is very important to have a strong medical delivery system as well as a strong public health system. And we all realize that you have many requests here for priorities. Some of these priorities, however, I think, as you can see, are those that make or break a situation. And I mean, none of us want to have a lot of excess capacity out there, but the bottom line, we live in a world today where these things happen. You know, I have been asked, for example, and while this is not the point of this hearing, but in the many years I was at the State Health Department, I was asked time and time again, you know, you deal with HIV/AIDS and meningitis outbreaks and all these things, you know, how do you sleep at night? And to my embarrassment, I guess I would tell people, and I told some of you, I did sleep at night, not a problem. I don't sleep at night right now over the concept of a pandemic of influenza that I think is breeding in Southeast Asia that could very well sweep through this state and kill 30,000 people in 1 year. That is a real possibility. That's what we live in the world of today. We have to be prepared not just for the average, everyday, this is the way it's going to be, but unfortunately these kinds of events are going to happen. Just as 9/11 happened intentionally, these kind of events will continue to happen, as will Mother Nature-made events. And somehow we've got to figure that into our equation.
Mr. Chair, just follow up on a question, just to bring it back to the higher ed committee. This is also a big question, but in terms of the significance of the University of Minnesota, what is the primary significance of a institution like that in regards to this entire issue of food defense?
Dr. Ostrom.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown. I can't begin to tell you the importance of the University of Minnesota. Again, as somebody who has always been associated with the university, but only more recently involved, and also, some of you know, since 9/11, I've been serving part-time as an advisor to Secretary Tommy Thompson at HHS and continue to currently advise Secretary Leavitt there. And being in that unique kind of triangle position, I can tell you it's engines like the University of Minnesota that bring together all the disparate pieces, that begin to think about not just how to get through another day, but how are we going to do this 5 years from now or 3 years from now? And I can't begin to say how important this is. You know, as Andy Granatelli once said, you can pay me now or you'll pay me later. And I think that a place like the University of Minnesota is exactly that. And this kind of demonstration is the fact that we never want this to happen, and our job is to try to figure out how not to make it happen. And while we're not in the luxury today to tell you all of this, but people like Sean Kennedy and myself have been working on exactly how to prevent that from ever happening. Even if somebody did have access to that tank and dump something in there, what can we do to make certain that it doesn't harm anybody? And we're working on those kinds of technologies that can be put right in line, that can keep the industry running just as is, and what that means. All it's going to take is one outbreak of somebody tampering with the milk supply one time, and we'll be dumping milk for years to come because the consumer trust will not be there. That's why investments like this can't even really be measured in real dollars and cents.
Representative Carlson?
Sure, and I've got a couple of questions, and my first one goes back to that slide where you put up the logos of various companies, many of them from Minnesota. And when I was looking at that, you were talking about collaboration, I recall, this goes back a few years, but I bought some corn in a can. And much to my surprise, when I got home and I was opening up one of the cans, there was Chinese writing on the label. It had been processed in China. And so my question is, when we're talking about this collaboration and so on, how do we handle food products, and we're getting more and more of them that are imported from other countries?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, you raise a very important point, and this is exactly part of what we have to deal with today. And this was in part the frustration that Secretary Thompson expressed when he announced his retirement a few months ago and made his now famous comment that he was surprised the food supply hadn't been attacked yet. Because when you look at the number of vulnerabilities both in our shore and overseas, that's a real possibility. So one of the things we do is work today with both those companies who are multinational, such as a Cargill or a Hormel or others, that actually do processing in foreign countries, or more specifically, companies that literally exist only in foreign countries and import into this country. And how do we determine whether or not there is potential contamination, or how do we stop it from occurring there? So it is a very, very overwhelming task, but you actually really hit on the sense of it when you raise that point. That's, we don't have the luxury of just taking care of it inside our borders. We've got to take care of it anywhere it comes from.
And just Mr. Chairman, I should footnote that maybe you picked up on it, but the logo was an American company. It was, I don't know, General Mills or whoever does corn. But it was a popular store brand is my point. The other question that I have goes back to your model there of tracing what happens with the contaminated ice cream. And, you know, there's the public health side of treatment. But I'd be interested in your thoughts about the preventive. I mean, do we have to test all of the product that's coming out of a plant to make sure it's not contaminated to begin with when we're talking about terroristic acts? I mean, I think we're all quite familiar with inspections and so on to make sure that the company that's producing whatever food product is doing it in a safe, sterile environment. And even then, things sometimes unfortunately happen. When you had the ice cream up there, I thought of Schwann's. But then you've got the added component now of potential terrorists. So does it mean greater inspection before that product hits the shelves? Or
yes.
Dr. Osterholm.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, again, let me just point out you hit on another very important point. When we hadn't ever anticipated that botulism, the toxin could just jump into a tanker truck or into a tank like that, we never worried about it. And so we didn't develop the test to be able to rapidly detect it in a very large bulk product like that. Today, the test we use is injecting mice and then actually giving them some antibody, injecting with the milk. And if they die in 2 days, then it's probably there. If they don't die, it's probably not there. This would be the equivalent if all of you here in this table today, instead of using your PCs, to doing mathematical calculations, and there's one or two of you old enough to remember a slide rule. We're still using your slide rule. That's the level of technology we have today for this because no one ever thought we would need it. So one of the things we're doing is fast-forwarding a whole series of technologies that we could test bulk tanks in a continuous flow nature. So if anybody ever put it in there, the alarm would go off and the thing would shut down immediately. They don't exist. That's part of the detection process we talked about so that we can, again, deal with that very issue as you lay it out. Go from the slide rule back to the PC as quickly as we can.
And then, Mr. Chairman, if you inject the mice and you know 2 days later, if I was following your process there, that would already be on the shelf.
Mr. Chairman, not only would it be on the shelf, but we wouldn't even necessarily pick it up at the level that could kill people with the sensitivity of our test. You got to have a big bolus there. Bot toxin is one of the most lethal toxins we know. So even our ability to make sure that the mice would really suffer all the illnesses is unclear. So it's not even that sensitive. We might pick it up in 2 days. It might even take us a little longer. So that's the level of where we're at today and what we're working on.
Thank you.
When it comes to labeling, we still have a ways to go on some products. Am I correct? Like meat, for example, is not all labeled as far as where it originates.
Mr. Chairman, let me just say that, first of all, some products are extremely difficult to label in the sense that it's not an issue no one wants to label it. But today it is true when you have ground beef, that ground beef may come from any one of 100 different animals that basically ultimately gets ground up into the ground beef. Today when you go to your local produce section of your grocery store and buy pears, those pears may have been sorted at a distribution center in Chicago or Minneapolis where pears from Argentina, New Zealand, and other parts of the world were all sorted on a given day and put back in the best ones were then put in a certain box. So problems with labeling and certain perishable items in particular is a real problem. Same thing is true with milk. It's one thing to basically go out and buy a container that's from a dairy, but don't forget that that may have come from one of 450 to 4,000 farmers that contributed to that, and again, how do you label? So your point's right on, but it's an issue that is confronting us today, how to keep track of where things come from. You know, today if you basically have a defective car, they can go pull a piece out and tell you exactly where that part came from, where it was manufactured, who contributed to the supply chain. We can't do that with a lot of the food supply today.
In the event of a widespread illness, you mentioned in your testimony that there weren't places for them. The hospitals were full and so forth. But what concerns me a little bit personally is that I come from a community that has a large facility that's empty. And some visualize that as an emergency hospital in the event of some catastrophe. But we're kind of racing against a wrecker ball. So, you know, we have those tugs where it's a kind of a financial liability on one side yet on the other side it could really be some security for the future on the other side. And so we struggle with that.
Mr. Chairman, I think that, again, you, the point of what is capacity here, I would refer this to Dean Powell, but it's not just a function of also the buildings. Today, we have a workforce that has been slivered down to almost nothing, and we're seeing major workforce problems in the healthcare area that, in fact, in our public health area, we're facing a major disaster. If you've been reading the recent national newspapers, over half of the national public health workforce at the National Institutes of Health and the CDC are eligible to retire in the next 3 years. We've done nothing to replace them. That is true in many areas around the country. So as much as your buildings are a very critical issue, I'd come back to why universities are important, because your workforce for today and tomorrow, somebody's got to take care of me someday, and I hope they have the training that they get at the University of Minnesota. I just hope they do.
Very, very important. You bet. Any other questions? Comments? Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, this has nothing to do with higher ed, but I just can't help asking this question. Because of the possible pandemic in Southeast Asia, I usually don't try to freak out over stuff that I read, but this really does hurt me too. What advice can you give the legislature? I know this is an international issue, but what can a state legislature do in regards to, if anything, in regards to the possibility of getting hit with a worldwide pandemic?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you know, this is not an official policy of the University of Minnesota. Let me make that very clear. Okay. But, you know, I look back at my colleagues in the Minnesota Department of Health right now, and they're watching both their federal and state sources being slashed at a time when I would think that if you were planning for a hurricane, you'd be thinking about maybe what you're going to do for evacuation routes and places to house people, etc. Well, we're not doing that for planning in this area. Look no further than the fact that when we got caught short-footed this past fall when we had a vaccine shortage and nobody had prepared for that yet, because we don't have time to plan for those things. Right now, we wouldn't know where to put bodies if they died as fast as we think they will from pandemic flu. We don't even have a place to put them. We'll run out of caskets in 2 weeks. We don't have plans for that. We don't have plans for how to keep the workforce going. So I think that you're right, but that's as bad as it may sound, that's true. And if you ask the health department, they'll tell you they're trying to work on this issue, but they're being stretched and pulled so many different ways. So I think the legislature may want to look at its flagship agency that's really going to be in charge of making something happen here and wonder what support they have in that area.
That takes care of it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Dean Powell, do you have some further good words for us?
We actually have two other speakers. The next presentation we have is the initiative called Brain Function Across the Lifespan. Neuroscience and brain science is very much a strength of the University of Minnesota, and we have a number of talented faculty. And the person who's going to speak to you today is the head of our Department of Neuroscience in the medical school. But we have faculty studying the brain across the continuum from education and psychology and social science and neurosurgery and neurology and radiology. Dr. Ebner is a scientist and an educator, and I think that he is going to talk to you about some of the initiatives in brain sciences at the University of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. As Dean Paul said, I'm Tim Ebner, and I'm a professor and head of the Department of Neuroscience at the University of Minnesota.
Okay. He's nervous when you bring a bag of...
With your permission, Mr. Chair's permission, I'm going to fulfill your worst dream here. If we could get the first slide up. And what I'd like to do today is tell you a little bit about some of the work going on in brain sciences at the university, and also the president's initiative. And I'll probably be one of the few people to testify before your committee who uses rubber gloves. What I'd like to do is do a little brain 101 with you.
And that's something.
Tell you about some of the things going on in the university. And what I'd like to do when I had the time I left today is convince you that this thing in the bucket is important and that
yeah,
the university...
Quit smoking. That's a lung.
That's a
more.
But this is a human brain. It's a three. It's 3 pounds. It has about 100 million neurons. They make about 1,000 to 5,000 connections each. Meaning there's trillions of connections in here. And I guess we haven't got the slide up yet. But it's a wonderfully complex organism that I think is going to have enormous impact as we start to understand this organ on society and the way we live and do things. A little bit behind there, but we'll just kind of move on.
We have a question, Doctor,
yes.
From Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Doctor. As a seventh grade teacher, I'm just wondering, when do brains stop growing in size?
Oh, that's a great question. They don't actually really ever stop. Now, in size, they will stop sometime in adolescence. But they grow, there's a lot of processing going on, and that's the heart of the president's initiative, because it's brain function across the lifespan. And it's the idea that the brain is really continually developing and changing, not only when you're in that embryo and as a child, but then as you go into adult, and then, of course, things start to happen in old age. And that's the whole theme here. So that's a great question.
Representative Bird also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So seventh graders' brains are still growing.
They are. And one of the nice things about brains are always changing. And that's how you learn and remember. That's a key concept. So if you actually do remember something from this hearing today, it's because your brain actually changed. And that's a remarkable thing. How are we doing, Marty?
I've often compared that to that. You know, it's your computer. Mine is sometimes full of data. Overloaded, in fact. Yeah. And it malfunctions.
There certainly are some analogies. However, I think that the architecture here would make a computer engineer jealous. They would love to be able to do what the brain can do, and they're still trying to work out some of those tricks. As we can see, the computer engineers here.
Put it up to the brain.
Pardon? Well, as long as we're on brains, I'll also... This is actually a human spinal cord. It's a little worse for wear. But this is actually quite remarkable if you look at this. Now, you might have thought this would be bigger, but that actually is the size of a human spinal cord. It's really a much smaller, it's about the tip of your finger. And this is very, very important real estate. Okay? Should count. Why did you?
Mr. Chairman, this reminds me of a time a number of years ago, the University of Minnesota was doing a presentation and they couldn't get their technology to work. And we had a page. And the page came forward and got it set up for them. Now our page just went out the back door. But it turned out he had a background in engineering at the university. So I think it was the dean of IT at that time who was having the difficulty.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Doctor, my wife is a neurologist who's a graduate of the University of Minnesota Medical School, and she's not going to believe what I did today.
is it the problem we don't have the screen back in the back?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you have it up on...
Yeah, we got it. We'll get it.
Have it there? Okay. Are you going to tell us the age of this particular specimen?
This was obviously a bequest brain from a donor. I don't actually know the age, but it's probably someone in their 50s or older. This is actually a hemi section of the brain, I'll point out some. As long as we're doing this, point out some very important features. So the brain in your head this is the back of your brain, and actually I'm going to tell you a little bit about this structure, the cerebellum back here, and that's very much involved in controlling your movements. Back here is the visual part of brain, and hopefully you will be able to visualize some PowerPoint things pretty soon here with that part of your brain. Actually up front is in this frontal pole is where you do some of your more executive functions. Part of the thing that develops most in humans and is probably responsible for a lot of our cognitive abilities. If you, I don't know if you can see this, but over there's a special lobe here. It looks like a thumb, and this is like where hearing is, but also memory. A lot of the memory systems are deep in here. Actually, of course, you can see that the brain is very foliated. It's got all these sulci that increases the surface area. This is the brainstem. It's going to go into the spinal cord. And the half brain here shows you something else. The brain is actually has these big ventricles or fluid-filled cavities. They're actually very, very important, but actually your brain is full of fluid that's sloshing around in here. There's also this other structure that, if I don't know, I may never get to this talk today, is something called the corpus callosum. And do you see this little thing here? Uh-huh. That connects the two halves of the brain. Mm. And if those are not connected, the two halves of the brain will act like you're separate people. And there are actually people who have this syndrome. Wow. And they really have two functioning brains that are independently doing what they want and sometimes actually fighting it out. Not going to work. Okay. Well, can we just turn it around for them?
Yeah.
Why don't we just turn it around for the committee? Yeah. Okay. And I will...
Just a question while we're waiting.
Sure.
I was watching a television program. This infant had some problems with seizures. They operated and removed part of the brain, half of the brain, to stop that particular problem.
Yes.
And expected the child to live quite normally with the remaining half of the brain.
Right.
Does the brain grow or compensate for, especially at that early age?
Yes. So the younger the brain is, certainly the more we call it plastic or ability to change. So if there are a number of cases of children who've had to have, like you said, because of bad epilepsy, remove a piece of the brain, or in virtually half of it, and it's remarkable how much control they can function they can gain if it's done young enough. So let's just start with the slides here.
Yes.
Yeah, just start now. And maybe somebody can click them for me because we need to turn it. So this, and I apologize to the audience, this is just to make a very quick point that... This is just a bunch of covers of Time magazine. You can see that if you don't believe me, brain function is really at the forefront of virtually everything in our society. And there's covers there on addiction, there's covers on Alzheimer's disease, there's covers on learning and memory and how the mind works. If we go to the next slide. Yeah. Okay, so, I can't see anything. what I want to do is tell you from two perspectives why it's so important. And one is, and again, it's this idea that really, when you think about it, who we are and what we are is because of what's going on in our head. So if you could click that, just click through the tabs. So, you know, how we think and feel, the fact that we can communicate, the fact that we can move, the fact that we have memory is a product of what's going on in our nervous system. Okay. Now, if you go to the next slide, we there?
I'm almost there.
Can you hold up the spinal cord and the brain for a photo?
Yeah, I'm doing nothing else here, so. Anyway, so you can't. It's is this Marty's computer that's doing this to me?
Yes.
You want my computer?
Yes.
Sure. Okay. I don't know if we're taking too much time. What would you like to do?
Go ahead.
Okay. The question is, if someone has a big head, do they have a big brain?
No.
There.
Hey.
They're cooking.
We can go back.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
I have used my time. Thank you, Bob. Can we just go to the slideshow? And I'm going to just do a few quick points. I know we're over time.
You know they don't have enough to go around.
Okay. I think we should give up on this and not waste the committee's time with. But let me just make a few comments. So I'd like to first convince you that neuroscience is a very widespread endeavor at the university, and I think we're so out of sync. It's okay. It's not only found in the medical school; it's found in there are neuroscientists in the dental school, Vet Med, College of Biological Science. There are people who call themselves neuroscience in institutes of technology. They're working on brain-related problems in the College of Education, even agriculture and food sciences. It's a very pervasive group of people because you have to attack solving this problem from all aspects. And if we're going to understand this beast, we're going to have to solve it from many aspects. And if you look just in the Academic Health Center, there are almost 100 people who are, who do research on the brain. They generate something like $30 million annually in funds. And I would like to say that they're a very distinguished faculty. 9 of these have been awarded something called NIH Merit or Javits Grants. Actually, Dean Elby, who's going to come up, is one of those. That's the most prestigious award that NIH offers to its researchers. And so the President's initiative, again, is to go from the development of this structure all the way up to when it matures, and then in old age, unfortunately, when some bad things start to happen. And if you look at this, there's some 15 million people who, just in the development stage in the United States, who have brain-related defects. And these are things like malformation of the brain, autism, dyslexia. 15 million people suffer from these disorders. And I'm going to click through some of these real quick. I'll just show a couple snapshots of some work. This is technology has just totally failed me today, hasn't it? It's not my day. Okay. This is a growth cone. This is how neurons connect up. They have to find their way, and they have to talk to the right partners. And that beautiful thing there is the thing a cell sends out to try to find its partner as the brain's development. And there are people at the university who are working on trying to understand how this does this, and what are the molecules that control this. Now, why this is so important, again, goes back to my comment about this corpus callosum. In the fetal alcohol syndrome, the corpus callosum is greatly affected. So as those neurons try to connect up across the brain, across the midline of the brain, there's something wrong with those growth cones, and they don't do that correctly. So if we could understand that, we may be able to intervene in this problem. Of course, ideally, we'd like to intervene with just the mother's not drinking, but let's face it, it still occurs, and we'd like to be able to solve problems like this. I'm going to jump to the adolescent brain. Things are brewing in there. Things are always still there that have happened, and they don't get expressed until adolescence or maybe young adult. This is something that's schizophrenia. That's definitely a disease of teenagers, young adults. You see addictive disease is very prominent in those individuals. They get addicted to things very easily as the nervous system develops. Now, there's a whole class of diseases, of genetic diseases, that involve this structure back here called the cerebellum, I mentioned. And the university is at the absolute forefront of understanding these diseases, but they don't, again, come on until later in adolescence or into early adulthood. And a group at the Institute of Genetics, Harry Orne's colleagues, were the first to find the genetic basis of this disease. They've been able to understand what happens in the cells in here. And now, and I won't show you on the slide for want of time, they actually have a way they can shut that gene off in a mouse. Okay? So they have mice that they've made this disease. They can shut the gene off, and they can show that the mice recover. So once you can do that, then there's hope. Because if we can shut the gene off or control it in the human, then you can reverse this disorder. Okay. Again, and these are just little vignettes of the things that are going on. I apologize, I'm going quickly. The mature brain. Okay, you get to maybe our age and you think you're safe. But of course, there's a lot of traumatic things that go on. Things like stroke, brain injury, and I'm going to show you something that's almost futuristic, but I think it's very interesting, and I'll take the time to show you this. Minnesota is one of the leaders in understanding the systems that control movement. And a lot of times when you have a stroke, what happens? You don't control your movements very well. There's a strip of brain here called the motor cortex, and Minnesota has, researchers in Minnesota have really understand, like Apostolos Georgopoulos, have understood the signals in there and how they control movement. Now, I'm going to show you something that actually wasn't done at Minnesota, but it was someone trained at Minnesota and took all that and applied these concepts. And you're going to see, I think, what is the future. And this is called the brain-machine interface. Can you get this? How can I get that pointer on there? You need to click on that. This monkey, let's go to the next one. No. Can you put the point on there? Okay, just go from the other one. Okay, what you're seeing is a monkey. It's implanted with electrodes, and it's going to just use the electrical signals from its brain to control an arm to feed itself. You see that? That? It's using to control a 7 degree of freedom arm to put food in its mouth. There, it's not doing so well, but it's using the signals from its brain. Again, because of work done that came out of the Minnesota faculty who began to decipher the signals in those brain areas, and you can now use that. Now, you can think about that if you have spinal cord injury. Can you take a patient, implant these electrodes, and then give them a robotic or a prosthetic so that that can really change their lives? Okay. And I'll make one more. Okay, let's close that and go back to the presentation. Now, sure. Do you think we need more money for technology?
I'll give you more.
Thank you. Okay, the brain in old age. When the brain gets old, and it's great we're all getting older, but the brain starts to degenerate. And you all know about things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. There are 4 million Americans with Alzheimer's. In 2050, there will be 13. Right now, it costs $60 billion a year in healthcare costs and loss of productivity. I can guarantee you this is the real Social Security crisis. There are not enough doctors, there are not enough nurses, there are not enough hospitals to take care of 13 million people with a chronic disease. This has to be solved. And I think, as you know, this is a disease where people lose their ability to think, they lose their memory, they really lose who they are. Okay. Now, again, I had some more props, but I'll pass. Basically, the Alzheimer's brain is dying. And here's a normal brain. You can see a normal brain. Yeah, I don't have a plan. Alzheimer's brain is shrunken. It's because cells in there are dying. And they're dying because an abnormal protein is being put there. This amyloid is a protein. And for some reason, the brains of Alzheimer's making patients is making this protein and depositing it. Now, I'm going to jump ahead, and I'm going to skip a few things. Now, one of the researchers at Minnesota, Karen Shalash, thinks she has the idea of why the Alzheimer brain does that. So, let me try to explain this. That's a nerve cell in the brain. You see that thing called APP? That normally is in your brain, and we all have it, and we all have enzymes that break it down. Now, you see those little red molecules at the bottom? What she's found out is in the Alzheimer, it looks like in the Alzheimer brain, there's a slightly different version of these molecules. We all have these. It's called A beta star. And this A beta star is the molecule that causes the other molecules to glump up. And when they glump up and accumulate, that would start in latent Alzheimer's, and it starts to build up, and then it starts to kill cells. That leads to mild cognitive impairment, and that eventually leads to full-fledged Alzheimer's disease. So once we know that the target is A beta star, then again, the search will be, can you find something that inhibits it, prevents it from happening? But then again, this is a significant step forward. So with that, I will close, and thanks, committee.
Thank you very much. Very, very interesting. And we have one more presenter, is that
right? Okay. Yes, and
is there a question for Dr. Ebner?
Hey,
Representative Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, do you do work with brain tumors then? That's one area you didn't reference, and just in the interest of time, yes or no, and if that's part of what you're...
I just touched on a few things. I mean, there is actually a very successful brain tumor program in the Department of Neurosurgery where they look at very advanced therapies for brain tumors, as well as the cause and mechanisms of brain tumors.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Dean Powell?
Yes, so our final speaker is my colleague, the Dean of the College of Biological Sciences, Dr. Robert Eldy, and Bob Eldy is also a professor of neuroscience, but he's going to talk about the initiative which is called New Product Through Biotechnology. And he really is going to talk about some of the successes in the college on the St. Paul campus, where we have a wonderful new Cargill building, which I hope some of you have seen. And we're sorry that we don't have
that. Dr. Eldy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I can be pretty flexible and condense this pretty rapidly, so tell me how much time...
We have about 20 minutes.
You do?
Okay.
Thank you. My colleague Dean Powell said, I'm Robert Eldy, Dean of the College of Biological Sciences. I was here with you just last week recounting the molecular and cellular biology and what that has done to transform the opportunities, and you've been hearing about those opportunities today, and that's really the focus as to the platform that you have helped us build and where we can take that. The topic I'll focus on today is what we call the President's Initiative related to new products through biotechnology, and you'll find that as a part of our biennial request along with the other topics that have been discussed today. This enterprise is really focusing on something we call biocatalysis. Biocatalysis is the ability for biological processes, namely enzymes or bacteria, organisms like yeast, to make products. And I'll be passing around some products here in just a little bit that illustrate how those biological processes, those enzymes and bacteria, can be harnessed to make products that bring value to things we can grow and things we can manufacture here in Minnesota. So biocatalysis, a complicated word, but it basically brings about the opportunity to turn away from the world of petroleum-based products and petroleum-based energy to products using biological processes. And you all know about the refinery, for example, down in Rosemont, that has big stacks where crude oil is refined into the products like gasoline and products that we then use to make things that look like these but are different in their starting material. That analogy is useful for what we can do now using biological starting materials, if you will. Biology has really become engineerable. That is, as we've gone down the absolute reductionist funnel to reduce all living organisms to their genomes, that makes those components, those parts, engineerable. You can lay all of those parts out on the table, if you will, and you can swap them. You can swap them from one organism to another. You can tweak them. You can kind of tweak them up. You can tweak them down. So you really gain control over the fundamental processes of life. And when you come to that point in a scientific enterprise, a new discipline is born. And so, for example, 150 years ago, physics came to the point where mechanical engineering was born. And when you have mechanical engineering, products came to market, the basis of the Industrial Revolution. Or electrical engineering came out of physics a little bit later. Or about 100 years ago or 90 years ago, chemistry gave birth to the discipline called chemical engineering. And companies around here like 3M, companies like H.B. Fuller, have capitalized dramatically on the ability to model and engineer chemical entities into products that hit the marketplace. Minnesota's economy is really dominated by that kind of thinking. And now we're at the very same point in biology, where given that the parts can be laid out on the desk, if you will, and engineered, there is now the possibility for engineering at both the molecular and cellular level. And that's a completely new, and in fact, just 2 weeks ago, MIT announced it, the first new major, undergraduate major at MIT in 29 years. And that major is called biological engineering. It differs from biomedical engineering, which has been with us now for perhaps 40 years, and really harkens back to the days of the birth of companies like Medtronic, where things like artificial where joints to replace damaged joints were the province of biomedical engineering, or the interface of electrode software and stimulators to shock hearts into more functional capacity. But now this is a very different kind of engineering discipline that's being born. And in fact, the Boston Globe from February 16th says, once the cutting edge materials of engineering were steel girders, then transistors, next MIT is gambling it will be DNA and cells. There's a book that I would commend to you for at least browsing. And they argue that there's a convergence that's occurring as we speak in terms of information technology, biology, business, and they ought to add nanotechnology to this subtitle as well. And they argue that our economy started out with an agricultural base, it progressed to an industrial component. We're now in the middle of an information-based economy, but we're stepping into an economy that will be based on what we can do with molecules and the value added to molecules. That molecular economy is really an economy based on the molecules of life. Carbohydrates, lipids. Carbohydrates, for example, are what give rise currently to ethanol that we're putting in our gasoline tanks. Lipids give rise to biodiesel, for example, proteins, polymers, complex organic compounds. And then the ability to create hydrogen as a fuel storage medium and electrons. So this is what they argue the next 10 years are going to look like. We're in this stage where we're in the midst of this information economy. We're just moving into this molecular economy, and that is going to really take hold in this next decade. And if something is emerging like that, you should count on your university to be the vehicle to help introduce that and to create the talented workforce that will be needed to carry this into Minnesota's economy. We have a number of advantages I've outlined here in terms of our economic base to capitalize on these developments. And I'd now like to just quickly review with you some of the kinds of products that arise out of this. I'll first pass around a little complicated looking flask here, and as you'll read on here, this flask says that it's mud from the Iron Springs Bog up near Lake Itasca. This is from the work of Daniel Bond, a new star we've hired to our faculty. And this little flask is actually the crudest form of a battery. There are bacteria in this flask that live deep in these bogs and deep under the soils that are capable of taking simple nutrients and creating electricity. And so there are two little outlets coming from there. And if Daniel puts electrodes in there, that turns into a battery. Electrical current comes out of that. And he's working, interestingly, on the genome, the analysis of the genomes of the bacteria that make those electrons out of those simple sugars that are found in that material. The next products I'll pass around here look for all the world like polyethylene or polystyrene products. If they were, they would have been made from crude oil that probably came from the Middle East. But instead, these are not made from that. These are made from corn, as is this container containing the drinking water Biota from Colorado. These are products from the company here in town spun out by Cargill. It was a joint venture of Cargill and Dow Chemical called Cargill Dow. Interestingly, I think Cargill thinks this is such a very interesting space that they bought out Dow's interests and now own that entity themselves. Here is a blanket from Faribault Mills. This blanket is made out of corn, this same fundamental polymer that was fermented using a bacterium that they've engineered, bacterium that is very closely related to the same bacteria that ferments milk into yogurt. That bacteria makes this polymer that makes this lactic acid that then's polymerized and makes this product. So these are from the heartland, from the breadbasket of America, but these are products, not bread. I add another couple of things. This is a container of what we might call bio-crude oil, where biomass has been heated, boiled, and compressed into what is the equivalent of crude oil. And there are all kinds of interesting things that can be harvested for both energy and product. And I think the final thing that I'll show you is a pigment that has been engineered through what we call gene shuffling by one of our real star faculty members, Claudia Schmidt-Dannert. And this is a pigment that is related to the family of vitamins and dyes that are used in the textile industry and vitamins and nutraceuticals for human consumption. Again, made by really clever, high-end biological engineering. And the final thing I'll pass around is a culture of bacteria that are, as we speak, degrading atrazine. Atrazine, as you know, has now for the past 30 years been used as a herbicide on the fields of the upper Midwest, and you know, and has now been appearing in alarming quantities in our groundwater. These bacteria are capable of breaking down that atrazine into harmless byproducts and thereby remediate the contamination that's occurred. So I say this to underscore the broad spectrum of applications across the way we live and across our economies that the university can help bring both the talented workforce and help introduce these products into Minnesota's economy.
We have a question from Representative Rudeau.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, just as much a question, but complimenting you on promoting these types of things. I want everyone to know that if you want to feel one of these, it's not in a bag. Come by my office. It's on my couch.
Representative Lance has a question.
Thank you, Doctor. A lot of these products probably have something in common, which is that they take energy in order to make them. The issue has come up specifically in the context of ethanol, but sure. I can envision it in the context of a lot of these different products. Is there a way to really measure if we're using more energy to produce some of these products than we save by utilizing these products?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a very good question, and there's some very good analysis that's going on as we speak at various centers around the world, but including here at the University of Minnesota. And I would say that it's very likely the case that the inputs required, for example, to make polylactic acid from corn, to make that blanket, or ethanol from corn, that the inputs are significant and are just at about the tipping point compared with the output that you get. Energy in, energy out. It's just about at the tipping point. And depending on the product and the process, it may go just slightly positive or slightly negative. But that, I think, is important for you to realize. This is the first generation of products using this biological Lego set. We envision very soon the second generation of products where you won't be using the kernel of corn, you'll be using corn stover. Or instead of corn stover and the whole process of fertilizing, tilling, and harvesting that corn, we'll be using mixed prairie grasses as the starting material. And in fact, there's a company in Canada, in Ontario, called Iogen, that is using cellulosic biomass, that is the corn stover or the grass itself, as the starting material instead of the kernel of corn. They're using genetically engineered enzymes, cellulases, to break down that cellulose into the constituent sugars and use that as the starting material. And when we're at that point, then it's an absolute and clear winner in terms of the net energy in to net energy out.
So,
Representative Lance.
So when the legislature is making policy decisions whether or not to subsidize ethanol plants in Minnesota, are you saying right now it may be a wash in terms of whether we're actually saving energy by using an alternative form of energy, or in this case, saving oil by, or dependence on oil by blending gas or something else, but that as the next generation comes around, this investment will itself pay off more down the road by developing or allowing the development of new and more mature technologies?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lass,
yes, I am saying that, but I would argue that that is to repeat that at this first generation series of products is not far away from the neutral point in terms of energy in, energy out. But I would hasten to add that there are many other considerations that should be included in policy decisions. For example, the use of fossil fuels and petroleum as the starting material, either for energy or for materials, is in the end putting what was sequestered carbon, that is carbon that was buried under the ground, either in the form of oil or in the form of coal, and putting that carbon up in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. Whereas if you use stuff grown from corn, made from corn or from prairie grasses, that is the process of photosynthesis takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. You then harvest that product and you put the same molecule of carbon dioxide back up in the atmosphere. So it's carbon neutral in that sense. That is, we're not adding more carbon to the atmosphere. So that's one and several other considerations. I would hope that when we're talking about the whole process of energy and products from renewable resources versus non-renewable and dwindling resources, I hope those arguments are taken into account as well.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To that point, Representative Latz and Dr. Maybe we're already nearing the second generation on ethanol because the figures that I've noted recently indicate that energy, you know, there's now more energy coming out that's going in energy production, that the plants when they were first being constructed were much less energy efficient than the ones are today, that these new plants are much more efficient and it is the energy is again more going out than coming in.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I'll get away from the ethanol wars here for a second.
Do you want a plant in St.
Paul? Have I got a plant to sell you? I think a tough question. When I look at referring to the book, It's Alive, and you have that graph going through the different revolutions of technology and its application to society. During a period of that time, the University of Minnesota Land Grant Institution was doing clearly involved in some pretty important
technology work, probably most likely in chemical engineering, electrical engineering, et cetera. At the same time that, because of his land grant status, was pretty widely accessible for undergraduates. And one of the things we do struggle with here, and I know the university struggles with this too, so this isn't meant to be a trap question, but one of the things we are struggling with is trying to think about a future for the University of Minnesota that I think from legislators' point of view, from any point of view, would try to avoid some kind of separation from those two kind of big functions of the University of Minnesota. And maybe that's not possible. But I'm struck that, you know, as we went through different periods of time of major engineering technological innovations, we were doing that while we were also being broadly accessible for students in undergraduate work. Trying to ask this in a safe way. In terms of this next wave of work, what relevancy does having university be broadly accessible for undergrads have, if any, on that? And if you want to venture further than that, can you envision a dynamic University of Minnesota that can do both of those functions well and compete well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, yes, I mean, you've clearly touched on an issue that is a deep and very complicated issue. And I would say from a personal perspective, and, you know, I think you'll have to ask our president and provost to be authoritative with respect to the university's position, that, you know, Minnesota is a state that's been great and become great because of the public's embracing of higher education and K through 12 education. And we have, through that embracing, you know, a number of higher ed institutions and opportunities. And, you know, in fact, as I remember statistics, we have, in terms of public higher ed facilities per capita, more than any other state in the country. So I think as we go down the pathway here, we're going to have to look at access and think about that broadly. And I think we're going to have to think about articulation and be better at articulating. You know, states like California are doing quite well in public higher ed. And they have, I think, probably far better articulation arrangements between their community college system and their flagship campuses. I think we have things to work on there. So I think we have to look at a method by which that what the university can only and can uniquely provide can be accessed, but I think we've got to be more creative in the way we articulate with our sister institutions to accomplish that down the road. But I would really defer the you know, definitive answers and big questions to our president and provost.
And that's, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Albee, that's an ongoing discussion right. that obviously we're having with your leadership and also among ourselves. What I was really kind of additionally trying to feel for is whether or not there is a vital link in terms of the ability to emerge new technologies and undergraduate studies. And any thoughts you might have on that might be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, if I may, you know, being a vibrant undergraduate campus is critical to success for a research university. Mm. There are very few research universities that are graduate only. I think I can count them on about two or three fingers. Rockefeller University, for one, where there is no undergraduate presence. You know, there is amazing power by the inquisitive nature, the naive questions, and the energy that undergraduates bring to a research university. For example, my colleague at Berkeley was the person who launched the Dog Genome Project. can sound like it was launched because of a question, an impertinent question an undergraduate asked in his introductory genetics class. And that dog genome project now has profound implications for not only how we understand some aspects of genetic regulation of human behavior, certain arthritic diseases that are prevalent in dogs, certain forms of cancer that are prevalent in dogs. That whole dog genome project, as goofy as it may sound, is hugely important, and had it not been for an inquiring undergraduate mind to poke that professor, mm-hmm. I don't know that we would have had a dog genome project. So I just use that as one example. We can cite many examples here mm-hmm. where that kind of a bright, vibrant undergraduate population is part and parcel of the whole discovery process.
It's very helpful. Thank you.
Dean Powell, do you have any final comments?
Thank the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This we apologize for our technological glitches.
It worked out fine.
But we really appreciate your attention. Thank you.
One question from Representative Carlson.
Just a quick one while we have Dr. Powell here. A number of years ago, we used to have some exchange programs with the medical faculty with some foreign institutions. I remember one of them was with Karolinska
right.
in Sweden. And do we still do that?
We do. We have a very vibrant affiliation with Karolinska. This summer, past summer, we just signed an affiliation with Shandong University in China. We have several exchanges. We had a group of Chinese scientists that came actually interested in medical education. They came this fall as a result of that. It's Sichuan University in Shandong, I'm sorry. But we do have affiliations and exchange programs. We're looking at Bangalore, India, for another exchange program, and we've had several scientists going over there, and we're starting what will probably be the Minnesota-Bangalore bone marrow transplant program very soon. So this is something that we're interested in, and how far we go with global health as a for our faculty, but also for our students.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, my question was faculty, but yeah. Obviously students as well. Thank you.
All right, very good. Well, it's been interesting, and thank you very much for coming. Thank you to everybody. Meeting is adjourned.